Hello, friends, and welcome to this episode of Textual Community, a podcast that explores the task of reading biblical texts in light of the canonical collection and within a confessional community. In this episode, I talk with Dr. Peter Gurry about some of his recent work in the field of New Testament studies and textual criticism. In our discussion, we address some technical and apologetic issues, but also reflect upon the historical and theological features of the New Testament that can give believers confidence and hope. Thanks for listening. Dr. Peter Gurry, I'm glad that you've joined us today to discuss some of your work on the New Testament and its text. Before we jump in, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do, maybe some of your teaching and research areas?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Chad. It's good to be here. So I teach New Testament at Phoenix Seminary, and I also co-direct the Text and Canon Institute here as well. So in my teaching role, I teach pretty much all the New Testament courses here. Right now, I kind of am the New Testament department. So that means I teach four semesters of Greek. I teach two survey courses, and then from time to time do some extra fun stuff. Like I teach a course right now on textual criticism, which is my area of expertise. And then I've also taught an elective on the parables of Jesus. So kind of anything within the New Testament is in my wheelhouse, or at least should be.
Okay. Yeah, good. So how did you become interested in the study of New Testament in general, but like text criticism in particular? Was it something that always interests you, or was there a particular issue or book or study that helped catapult you into this area?
Yeah, it's a great question. There were a number of factors. So probably the first one was that in high school, I went to a Christian high school in Cincinnati, and it just happened that the principal at the time taught two courses. He taught two classes along with being principal. One was drama, which I was not interested in, and the other was Greek, New Testament Greek. And So I had the choice as a freshman of taking Spanish or Greek, and everybody else took Spanish, and I typically did not like doing things that a lot of other people did. I kind of liked being different, I suppose. So I signed up for Greek, not really knowing what I was getting into, and ended up taking 4 years of Greek at the high school level, and really just loved it. Was just enjoyed the language, but also loved, I think it was my sophomore or junior year, that he bought us all Greek New Testaments for class. And that kind of was like, that was kind of a watershed for me, because I was really kind of blown away that there was this thing behind my English Bible that I had never really known about before. So I was the kind of beginning Greek student who was trying to correct, you know, my NIV translation when I should not have been.
A cage stage text critic.
There you go. And then we also had a really strong emphasis on missions in my home growing up. And so I always had an interest in missions. And when I went to college, I went to Moody Bible Institute thinking that I would do Bible translation. And my sister had gone there just a little bit before me, and she did go into missions, and she had told me that a lot of her friends there told her, tell your brother to do the languages at Moody, and then he can do the linguistics and translation stuff with like Wycliffe later, because Moody's language department is really good. Their linguistics department is good too, but you'll get just as good a linguistics from, you know, like Wycliffe. So I thought, oh, okay, so I'll do that. And I already had Greek, so I thought, great, I wanted to anyway. So I did. I dove right into the languages and started Greek right away, which they don't usually let you, or at least then they didn't usually let you do. But because I'd had so much of it, they made an exception and let me take Greek my freshman year. And that just really solidified it even more. And then it was probably my second year of Greek there when we learned about textual criticism. And for me, it was like going one step further back. So in high school, it was kind of like I had realized there was something behind my English Bible. And that was like fascinating to me. I was kind of shocked that there was something behind my English Bible. Then when I got to Bible college, it was kind of the next further step. It was like, well, how do we get our printed Greek New Testament then? And textual criticism was basically the answer to that question. So I think it's fair to say for a long time, I've been fascinated by the question of how we got the Bible. And I'll mention one last stage too. There's obviously lots of details in between these, but the last stage was that once I became interested in textual criticism, I decided to go to Dallas Theological Seminary, where Dan Wallace was a professor. And I knew that one of the things he did at the time, he still does it today, but I knew he was taking trips to Europe and photographing Greek New Testament manuscripts. And I read in like one of his early blog posts how he had taken students with him. And I just thought to myself, well, that would be like the greatest thing in the world if I could, if I could see an actual manuscript in person. And so actually it wasn't too long into my seminary career where I did get to go on a trip with him. And I was found myself in Athens looking at a very old copy of the New Testament. And I think it's fair to say that was settled at that point. Like from that point on, there was no doubt about what I wanted to do. So I always tell people, be careful if you ever go look at a Greek manuscript, it may change. But yeah,
that's a good marketing for the text criticism department, just to pass around the manuscript and see whose eyes light up.
That's right. Because it, you know, the thing I always remind students is every manuscript is different. That's kind of almost by definition, right? They're all made by hand. They're all handcrafted. And so you kind of never know what you're going to expect until you open one. And that's really the excitement of it.
Well, and recent areas of interest with the paratextual significance of the artifacts of manuscripts. So each manuscript has a story to tell in addition to the text that it's presenting. That's always fascinating to see as well. Well, before we move into, like, I had some things I wanted to ask you, but just hearing your story of, you know, kind of how you fell in love with the Greek languages and the Greek New Testament, what would you say to somebody who is maybe doesn't have that natural itch, but is training for ministry and is working through Greek? So maybe just some like internal motivations, but then also like, what have you found the most helpful as you teach students Greek? As maybe not necessarily like study habits, or maybe like just some tips or advice for someone starting out that's, you know, seeing this mountain and experiencing like the Greek fog for the first time.
The overwhelming feeling of dread. a lot of things I could say. I mean, I joke with my students that half my job as a Greek teacher is to be a cheerleader, you know, and to remind them that they can do it. Keep going. It's okay. It's going to be okay. There's no other class I teach where I have to do as much reassurance as I do in that class. So, I think it's one, that's one thing to say is just own up to the fact that it's hard. Like just, I want to say this carefully and sympathetically, but like get over it. In the sense that it's not going to change, like it's not supposed to be easy. If I was joking with my students, if there was a way to make Greek easy, we would have figured it out already, right? You know, and then they wouldn't hire me to teach it, you know. So I always laugh when I occasionally see these books in like Greek in 15 minutes a day or something, and it's like, maybe, but I kind of doubt that. So just kind of, you know, get serious about it and realize it is going to be hard, and that's not a bad thing. The difficulty of Greek is not a problem to overcome. It is, think of it more like a test to face, and then to test, let it test your mettle and lean into that. And then be, you know, depending on the student, you may have some things to learn in Greek class that have nothing to do with Greek and have a lot to do with your own spiritual maturity, and that's really good. So I sometimes tell my students in Greek that I'm going to teach them three languages: Greek, English grammar, and then just grammar itself has like its own language. But then there's this fourth thing that sometimes I teach students without intending to, and that's humility. Because some students come into the class and they're really smart, they're really sharp, and they've had a pretty easy go in their other classes. And then all of a sudden Greek is a different animal, and doesn't come easy. And I've had a number of students over the years who it's just a really humbling experience. And I just say to them, that's really good for you. I would hate for you to go into ministry and have never had a real good humbling experience. So if a student is listening and they fit in that category, again, I would encourage them to just treat it as a spiritual matter and pray about it and ask the Lord if humility is part of what he wants to teach them through the class. So lots more I could say about study habits and such things, but I do think there's some really important just spiritual elements and issues of just maturity that are involved, which is, again, one of the reasons why I love teaching it. I love it for the language. I love it for the exegetical benefits, of course, but I also love it for the way it develops my students' character.
Yeah, that's really helpful, because some of the advice that's needed seems harsh, but is actually in the end encouraging. Well, let's transition to thinking about some of your work in this area. Last year, you published a book with your colleague, John Mead, on canon formation, scribes and scriptures, the amazing story of how we got the Bible from Crossway. So in this book, y'all covered a host of different historical questions about how different biblical books were received and when some of the canonical lists began to form. But alongside the story of how the canon formed, you also include the story of text transmission, or how the texts themselves were copied and transmitted. So I thought maybe we could start with thinking through the question, what would you say are some of the core components of this discipline of textual criticism, if you're trying to boil down some of the goals or just kind of how you would characterize it? And then also, the broader question is, why do you think it's important to include a discussion of text critical issues when we're talking about the origin of the Bible?
Yeah, it's a good question. So maybe we can start by answering the question, why do we need to, what is textual criticism? First of all, it's not criticizing the Bible. It's not, you know, taking a negative stance toward it. Mm-hmm. Textual criticism is required anytime we have a piece of literature, and this could actually be ancient or modern. People usually think text criticism is just for ancient documents. It's not. It's also for some modern works also require textual criticism. But it's required anytime we have copies of a literary work and we don't have the original and the copies don't agree with each other. And for whatever reason, you want to know what the original said. Now, there's lots of reasons to want to know what that original said. Just pure historical interest can be one. That's reason enough for many people. But for us as Christians, of course, there's the added interest in wanting to know what the original author said, because we believe they are inspired. We don't believe that the later scribes who miscopied them were inspired. So we want to try to distinguish between text that was, let's say, written, and I use that term loosely here, but text that was written by a scribe and text that was written, say, by the Apostle Paul. So that's the basic impetus for it.
So when you're thinking about the relationship between textual criticism and like if doing something like in this Crossway book, you're trying to tell the story of how we got the Bible. How are you balancing like the deep dive into minute details with some of these broad sweeping claims that you would need to make to answer this question? You know, how did we get the Bible?
Yeah. How do we balance that? I'm not sure, Chad. We did our best is the short answer. I mean, it's a real trick to try to write about a subject like textual criticism that is at the academic level can be an extremely, I was going to say tedious, but that's not the word I want. It's a very careful enterprise. Let's put it that way. It requires a lot of attention to detail and a lot of skill. That much of which needs to be carefully honed over years of practice. So what we try to do in the book is give people the essentials, if I can put it that way, also give them a sense of why it needs to be done, give them a sense of how bad is the situation, if I can put it that way, meaning like how difficult is it really to do this, and is it so difficult to do this process that we're left not really being sure what the Bible even says? That's obviously a big question for many Christians. So we try to address some of those big questions that always come up when Christians ask about textual criticism or learn about it for the first time. So one way we do it is just try to introduce them to the evidence that we have. So in the case of the New Testament, we're dealing with Greek manuscripts. We're dealing with early translations of the New Testament into languages like Syriac and Latin and Coptic. And then we have a third category of evidence that we call patristic citations, which is those places where early Christian theologians or pastors or writers quoted the New Testament. That also is a type of evidence for us. So trying to introduce people to the variety of evidence and show them why that variety itself is one of the reasons to be encouraged about our ability to do a good job. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Yeah, one of the things that y'all, by putting these major areas together, one, demonstrating the fact that canon formation, text criticism, or thinking about the text of the New Testament and the Old Testament is by nature necessarily interdisciplinary. It's requiring a whole bunch of things like paleography, you know, what is this material made out of? How did books be made? What is scribal practices, to say nothing of what church communities were thinking and how biblical authors and the meaning of texts relate to all of those things. I thought one of putting those kind of stories together in the as you did in this a book like this and some of your other work, it highlights some things that perhaps when someone's just thinking about how do we get the Bible, they're not necessarily thinking about the discipline of textual criticism, even as you've described it here. But one of the things that y'all emphasize as a starting point that typical readers are just thinking about doesn't recognize is that to preserve a biblical text meant to copy it. So the fact that this that these copies exist is not necessarily because of a nefarious reason or the fact that, you know, some other factor, but part of that was at its core the attempt to preserve these texts, which introduced all of these things that text criticism is seeking to study. And so sometimes I think that's a surprise, but then helping people see that there are, the whole discipline is designed to help you navigate that very real reality that's there in the earliest churches.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, people, I mean, just similar to today, but people in the ancient world, certainly even more so, copied things they valued. You know, so copying was not something you just did sort of on a whim. It was certainly not something you did cheaply. It could be quite expensive and required a lot of effort and resources depending on what you wanted to copy and how much of something. So like a complete copy of the Bible in the fourth century, it was very, very expensive. It's not the kind of thing that people were walking around with and doing their own private devotions with, because you just couldn't afford it. So it's, you know, remarkable to see how many copies of the New Testament we do have over time. And it's a testament to, I mean, it's a testament to a number of things, but certainly to the spread of Christianity, but also the value that Christians placed on the Bible. You know, mm-hmm. it's been fairly said that Christianity is a religion of the book. Right. I mean, that's, you don't have to be a Protestant to say that, although as a Protestant, I will say that. Right. but we are definitely a religion of the book. Our faith very much centers around what this book says, and therefore you need to have copies of it. Mm-hmm. So
let's circle back around to this idea of the difficulty of talking about a very technical topic in accessible terms. So it seems like you're doing this in the book, but also with the Institute, the Text and Canon Institute, where you're working in on scholarly projects as scholars and professors, but also seeking to communicate that like at a church or a conference. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty that we always, a lot of times run into as we're assessing works of scholarship or reading and making use of resources that are aimed to help, you know, lay level readers or just someone trying to understand this for the first time. The more readable something is, usually the less nuance it gets. And then the more nuanced and accurate a description is, the less readable and much more boring it becomes for most readers. So I was struck reading Scribes and Scriptures that this is a both sections, the historical sections and the text critical sections, did a really good job of making things accessible. But then there are some places when you're talking about these issues that it's an irreducibly complex issues. And so if you try to make it, you know, just say something like, well, you know, this ancient paper, versus like this, you know, ancient writing material that's found, mm-hmm. you know, a papyrus or something. Mm-hmm. And then the more explanation and details, the less readable it gets. So,
yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a balancing act for sure.
And what do you think is, what are some of the central things when you're thinking about this particular discussion? This kind of segues into another broad topic of like, what would you say are some of the most helpful ways of defending the reliability of the New Testament text? And, what do you think about are there unhelpful ways that well-meaning apologists and scholars use arguments or ways of framing things to defend the canon and the text of the New Testament?
Yeah, it's good. I think in the book I have a section called Avoiding Sensationalism, which is sort of maybe the short version of what we try to do in the book is try to avoid the sensationalism. That's not to say things aren't exciting about this topic, but sensationalizing them is when you sort of play them up too much or try to prove too much from too little, or there's any number of ways you can kind of over-sensationalize elements of this discussion. But yeah, there definitely are unhelpful ways. My prior book that I edited with my friend Elijah Hickson is called Myths and Mistakes in New Testament Textual Criticism. And that one, we address that question more head on, where each chapter looks at a different kind of misconception about this. The kind that typically gets made on our side of things, if I can say it that way. So on our conservative evangelical side of the debate. So things like people tend to overplay the number of manuscripts that we have, or maybe overplay how much it matters that we have so many of them, or think that number alone is what matters when it's really the number and quality. And in many ways, quality is much more important than number. So things like that, or people tend to, you know, there's sort of some myths that are longstanding, like the idea that we can reconstruct the whole New Testament just from the citations in the church fathers, which turns out is not really true. But it sounds, you know, sounds exciting if you can say that. So yeah, that whole book, that book addresses each of those. And in Scribes of Scripture, we don't really address those head on so much as we just try to illustrate what we hope is a responsible way to do it. And I do think you can make a good case for the reliability of the text of the Bible. Keep in mind when we talk about that word, that, you know, there's a distinction between the reliability of the Bible and the reliability of the text of the Bible. Those are two different things, right? Mm-hmm. So to make a comparison that will, I think, make perfect sense once I say it to our listeners, is the text of the Quran has been copied probably much more faithfully than the text of the New Testament has been. But I do not think that for that reason, the Quran is truer than the Bible is, right? So there's two different things. You can have variance in the Bible and still know what it says. Do you know what I mean? And then you still have to ask the question, well, is what it says true? So that's an important distinction right off the bat. But naturally, it is kind of the first question, because if you have no idea what it says, then people who say they know what it says are basically, you know, on really unstable ground. But I don't think that's the case. I think when it comes to the biblical text, particularly the New Testament, we're on very good ground overall. So yeah, I could maybe give more specifics if you want them, but
yeah, well, I thought in Myths and Mistake, the larger work that you edited, most of the entries are trying to navigate so like a rhetorical claim that, you know, in our circles, or my circles, we'd say you know, that'll preach. preach. But part of what we mean when it'll preach is that it very clearly communicates something, and it's memorable. So one of the things that book, I'll post in the show notes as well, the kind of thinking through a particular issue by kind of nuancing and qualifying the claim that'll preach, but also qualifying the criticism that will also preach to a different kind of community. Making through, you know, in some ways, not necessarily like, well, let's just find the middle ground, but more so making the argument in a way that is careful, but also accurate to the evidence. It's a very difficult thing to do, but.
Yeah, it is, especially because, you know, oftentimes the biggest problem is what you leave out. Right. It's some sort of context that you leave out that ends up not giving a full picture. So a great example of this sort of on the other side is when people like to say things like, well, you know, there's 500,000 variants in the New Testament, and that's more variants than there are words. You know, therefore, how could you think you could get back to the original text? And it's like that's statistically true. Now, the total number of variants is an estimate, but we haven't actually bothered. We haven't counted all of them because it's a lot of work, and who wants to do that? But but it's a lot of variants, and there almost certainly are more variants than there are words in the New Testament. But what does that comparison actually show? It doesn't really show anything. At best, it shows that if you're a professional textual critic, and your job is to make an edition of the New Testament, and you decide, which I think would be a bad idea, but you decide to work through all the variants, you have a lot of work to do. You have a lot of variants to look at. it doesn't tell you how hard they are to work through. It doesn't tell you how confident you will be on the other side of having worked through that. Like, there's a lot of things that bare statistic just sort of leaves out of the picture. And the other thing, in my opinion, it also is not even a good representation of the quality of work of New Testament scribes.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives the impression that somehow scribes are just out there changing the text at every chance they get. But it's an unfair comparison because you're taking the total number of variants and comparing it to a fixed number of words in the New Testament. So by definition, every time you add a new manuscript, you're probably going to get some new variants. So that number can grow depending on the number of manuscripts. But your number of words in the New Testament, that's a fixed number, right? Depending mm-hmm. on which New Testament you're looking at. So, I always use the example. I say it's sort of like comparing the number of car accidents today to the number of car accidents, say, 80, 90 years ago, whatever, and not accounting for the fact that there are a lot more cars on the road today. The real comparison would be to say how many accidents, say, per car or even per mile, something like the number of injuries sustained, and maybe even then you want to factor in how fast the cars are going. Given that cars, when they're invented, are going like, 15 miles an hour, you can imagine the injuries are going to be pretty slight. So the point is to say there's a number of variables that sort of get left out of that comparison that mean it doesn't actually tell us very much of anything useful. Mm-hmm. So the comparison I try to make that still has its limitations is I say, what if we compare the number of variants to the number of words copied in the manuscripts those variants actually come from? And when you do that, the number changes quite dramatically. You get something like one new variant for every 400 words copied by a scribe. Well, that actually makes it sound like scribes were pretty good overall. Mm-hmm. Not perfect, certainly. We wouldn't expect them to be, but it's a little bit less dramatic. So that's what we mean by saying, not sensationalizing.
Yeah. Well, and it also is a good example of the complexity of, or the need for the discipline, where it's a data-driven discipline, but you're not only looking at data, but you're also looking at the interpretation of that data and the way in which you come about it. One of the ones that I've heard you work through before, specifically when you're thinking about the number of variants. So on the one hand, someone might claim about, there's no two New Testament manuscripts that are exactly the same. And that's usually presented sometimes as a kind of a shock claim. But one of the things to contextualize that would be something like, well, this is expected in this, the fact that if it's copied, there will be some mistakes. And then thinking about the reason why that's the case. Is sometimes missing as well, because I've heard you say in your one of your chapters, backing off of the claim that the idea that there's 500,000 is a quite a big number, and then one of the ways to respond to that is to just relativize it and say, well, none of that matters for doctrine, but pointing out that most of the variants are clear, easy to discern scribal errors or mistakes, but that there are some that do affect and that we still can't ignore.
And there's a way to say that none of them affect doctrine that I think is true. You could say something like my mentor Dan Wallace will like to usually qualifies it in important ways, where he'll say no viable variant affects a core doctrine of the Christian faith. Well, that's two important qualifications. He's saying there isn't a variant where we really are sort of not sure what the original text is, and it's a hard choice we have to make between, say, two readings, and a core doctrine of the Christian faith is at stake. That I think that's fair. I can't think of a variant in the New Testament where it's like, depending on which reading I think is original, Jesus rose from the dead or he stayed dead. Mm-hmm. The New Testament is pretty clear on this one. No matter which manuscript you read, that Jesus rose from the dead. So, that kind of thing. But at the same time, there are passages that are argued about and debated, or where there are differences in our manuscripts that touch on things like questions about women in ministry, for example. Those come up a lot today. I'm trying to think of some other examples, but there are other places where certainly a doctrinally important statement is affected by a variant,
mm-hmm.
which is not the same thing as saying that doctrine itself is at stake.
Right.
But where a verse that is important to a doctrine is, you know, there is an issue. A classic one of these, and I don't think this is not actually a hard one in my mind at all, but 1 John 5:7 has historically often been read as a key proof text for the doctrine of the Trinity up until, say, the 19th century, probably. There's every reason to think that verse, 1 John 5:7, about the three heavenly witnesses, that the so-called comma Johannium, or the Johannine clause, that's not original to 1 John, that John did not write that. It's found in less than a dozen Greek manuscripts. It's not found in Greek at all until something like the 14th century. So there's, in my mind, there's no reason to think it's authentic. Does that mean that doctrine of the Trinity is at stake? No. Like, you know, how did the Greek-speaking half of the church come to believe in the doctrine of the Trinity without that verse? The answer is the rest of the Bible. Like,
right?
Like, so it really only is at the time of the Reformation when that verse has come to be used as a key proof text in, particularly in the Latin-speaking church. And then at the time of the Reformation, it's in Latin Bibles. And it's taken as a key argument against Arianism. And it just happens that at that time you have people like the Socinians who are, you know, resurrecting Arianism. And so both sides of the debate kind of decide this verse is crucial to their side. So the Socinians think it's great if they can prove the verse is not original, because they think that's the only proof text for the Trinity. And the other side, unfortunately, tends to agree with them and think, yeah, it's a key proof text that sort of shows your side is wrong. Where what they should have done, in my opinion, is said, you know what, there is some question about this verse. Even if we think it's authentic and is a good proof for the Trinity, look at all these other places from the scripture where we can prove the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That I wish more had done that, if I can put it that way. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're saying that there's some of these textual variants certainly are in texts that we would want to think very carefully about and that have implications.
Yep.
But then also in light of the fact that the larger majority of that 500,000, the presence of those variants relate to things that would be very disappointing to you if you were looking for something like super interesting.
Yes, it depends who you are and what you define as interesting.
Many of them
are very dull and not interested. Nobody tends to get super excited about it. You know, the interchange of a debt and a chi.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, and that kind of is something, especially with some of these apologetic claims, either for or against the reliability of the Bible, either Old or New Testament, is that all of these points of data or variants or, you know, manuscript issues matter. The question is who they matter to.
Who they matter to. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. And exactly. And it also, it's sort of a question of like, how detailed a study are you doing of the text, do you see? Mm-hmm. And what question do you need answered from the text? If my question is something about Mark's style, and particularly his style of his use of conjunctions, like I'm interested in his use of grammar, well, then those differences between debt and chi actually do matter, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think any of us would say they matter to the question of, say, does Mark think Jesus rose from the dead? Or even, does Mark think Jesus is divine? Like, That question is not going to be settled by small interchanges of conjunctions in Greek, right? Mm-hmm.
Right.
So even just today, I'm looking at 1 Corinthians 11 for a question I'm answering from somebody at my church about the Lord's Supper, and there are variants that no doubt would affect the interpretation of this passage at some points,
mm-hmm.
where scribes have, I think, made certain things more explicit than Paul did. So that, you know, that matters for the question I'm answering for this guy to some degree. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, I don't think any of them are that hard to resolve. I'm not left in a great deal of doubt as to what I think Paul actually wrote. I have a pretty good deal of confidence in that.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't say, you know, the choice between these two variants has no effect whatsoever. That right. I can't say, right? And so it's a question of what do they affect?
Yeah. Picking up on something that you said there at the end, maybe just speak to the nature and role of conjecture in this discipline. You say a few times in your some of your work and then in the Scribes and Scripture book, but that the idea, you make a claim or a statement, something like, it's remarkable how rarely an editor or scholar has to guess about a textual reading. So what do you mean by that, and how would that inform the picture of you know, what we're doing?
So what we call conjectural emendation, or just conjecture for short, is basically when a scholar looks at the manuscript evidence and says, you know what, I think all of them are wrong. None of them make good sense. And I'm going to have to use my skill, my knowledge of this author that I'm working on, my knowledge of Greek grammar, my knowledge of the historical setting, whatever it may be, okay, and guess, make an educated guess at what I think the author actually wrote, okay? In textual criticism of classical works, this is quite common, and it's expected that any work of most works of classical antiquity are going to require conjecture at some point, because we just don't have that many manuscripts for them. And there's a decent chance then that all the manuscripts are corrupted at the same point. For the New Testament, we have so many manuscripts at our disposal that most New Testament scholars today have been pretty hesitant to accept conjectures. Okay. Now, some people don't like that, and there are scholars who want to push back against that and say they're too hesitant. They should be more open to the idea of conjecture. That's a legitimate debate to have. But at least in actual fact, if you look at something like the Greek New Testaments that we have on offer today, the three main ones that I'm thinking of in particular, I think two out of the three have no conjectures at all, and the other one has like two. Okay, so it's very rare. That editors of our Greek New Testament decide, yeah, we have to conjecture. We have to guess here because we think all the manuscripts are wrong. One of the places where they've done it in the what's called the Nestle-Aland Greek New Testament or the UBS Greek New Testament is at 2 Peter 3:10, where the previous edition said, the earth and all her works will be found. And then usually that gets translated as something like will be exposed. And the most recent edition of those Greek New Testaments has the earth and all her works will not be found, which is sort of sounds like the opposite. Right? Like you put the word not in there. Why? Because they think without the word not, it just doesn't make sense. And if you put the word not in there, it not only makes sense of the text of 2 Peter at that point, but it also makes sense of how you get. We have like four or five other readings at that point in the tradition, in the manuscripts, right? So they think putting the word not in actually explains best how you got all the other readings. That reading also, with the word not, is also found in a few Coptic manuscripts and a few Syriac manuscripts. So it's not completely unattested. So some people even would argue about, is it a true conjecture or not? I don't really get too upset or too worked up about that particular semantic debate. But yeah, that's an example. That's one of them's in there. What's interesting about that one in particular is that English translations pretty much come away with the same interpretation either way. So if they translate it with the word not, which only one does to my knowledge and only in a footnote so far, it translates it as will not be found. But without the word not in the main text, it says something like will be found out. In the sense of sort of exposed. Does that make sense? Now, there's debate about whether the Greek term can actually mean that or not. But the point is, when it comes to actually interpreting the difference between the text, English translations today at least show they pretty much come to the same conclusion whether the word not is there or not, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah. When you're thinking about along these lines, there's one idea that when we're reading an eclectic text, like most of us who are studying the New Testament are the Nestle-Aland or the UBS. In a text like that the earliest or original, depending on how you want to say that the goal of textual criticism of that the earliest or original reading is either above or below the apparatus line. Like it's either in the text or it's in one of the options.
It's on the page.
Yeah.
Yep. I think that's probably fair to say. Now, as a text critic, the only caveat I need to add to that is, okay, the Nestle lawn is selective in its apparatus. Okay. Usually my students find that it still includes too much information. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I do want, it is selective. And there are interesting variants that are not in it that I've come across over the years. So that's mm-hmm. part of the fun of getting beyond it is you're exposed to more readings. And, you know, one of the things to say about variants is like we can tend to think that it's easy to think like, okay, the point of variants is to look at them, figure out which ones are wrong, are the mistakes, you know, and then ignore them and get on with it. And I understand mm-hmm. that certainly, you know, for a lot of what we want to do, that's fine. But we also have to remember that like these variants, when they're listed in our apparatus, can look like these isolated things. But at some point, these variants lived in a manuscript, if I can put it that way. Mm-hmm. And they were read by somebody and used by somebody. And so I think it's important to remember that behind our nice, neat printed apparatus are a host of manuscripts. And those manuscripts were somebody's Bible. They were the Bible to a Christian community. And that, I think, you know, does account for part of the current interest in things like paratextual features of manuscripts and also just reminding ourselves that the manuscripts are sort of manuscripts first, and then yes, we can sort of distill the text from them and put it and cite it in our apparatus, and that's all fine and good, but like there is this thing that's a physical artifact behind it that we should not ignore or forget exists, mm-hmm. and that is important to say.
Yeah, that's helpful. Well, I have several more textual criticism questions I'd, you know, like to talk about, but I did want to ask you your thoughts on, you've looked at this a few times, that thinking about the role of manuscript discoveries as we're continually adding to our knowledge of the ancient world. One of those is, you know, we're digging and figuring out what we're finding in these Egyptian dumps that are being excavated. So recently an early papyrus manuscript fragment was formally published that includes a bit of wording from some sayings from perhaps the Synoptic Gospels and maybe the Gospel of Thomas. This recent manuscript discovery or publication of it, what would you say the significance of this particular fragment is? And then kind of as an example of what the role of these manuscript discoveries have for the most part, for our reading of the New Testament.
Yeah, it's a good question. So just for a bit of background for your listeners, if they don't know, about, let's see, is it not quite a month ago, I think, August 31st, so close to a month ago now. The Egypt Exploration Society, which is a organization based out of England, that over a century ago, it was founded basically from the discoveries of two Oxford professors who went to Egypt and found a large trove of papyrus, a huge trove of papyrus in a little city called Oxyrhynchus. And it was a trash dump. So it was a place where people threw manuscripts away, which is sort of like amazing for historians because it includes all sorts of stuff. It includes classical texts from the poet Sappho. It includes copies of like the Iliad and the Odyssey. It includes New Testament fragments. But then it also includes stuff like letters, you know, between a dad and his son who's away from home, and it includes lots of receipts of everyday kind of things, and just gives an incredible window into everyday life for people living in Alexandria, Egypt, and to some degree around the Roman Empire as well. But anyways, so what's really amazing and what often surprises people today is that even though that discovery was made over 100 years ago, we still don't know everything that's in it. Mm-hmm. So still sort of making new discoveries out of that one initial discovery. It's really a series of discoveries. But so you can go today. I don't know if they'll let you in, but I've seen it with my own eyes, so I can attest that if you go to Oxford, there is a library there. They have a library there that houses these papyri, and they just kind of have them in what look like shoeboxes. And if you see them, they're just tons and tons of these fragmentary pieces of papyrus in these like shoeboxes. And so, you know, every year or so, the Egypt Exploration Society publishes a new volume in their long-running series of Oxyrhynchus papyri. And so just last month, they published the most recent one, which is volume, what I think it's 87. And in it, they published a fragment of this little piece of gospel material. The fragment itself is, goodness, like the size of an envelope, maybe. Okay, a smallish envelope. And it does seem to have text from the Synoptic Gospels and from the Gospel of Thomas. And the Gospel of Thomas is a second century non-canonical gospel with 114 sayings of Jesus. And so this particular fragment has sayings about not worrying. So it seems to be from like the Sermon on the Mount, right? When Jesus tells us not to worry and tells us how like the flowers and all their glory don't compare to Solomon. Or it's the other way around, sorry. Solomon does not compare in all his glory to the flowers, right? So if the flowers don't worry about the what they wear, neither should you. Okay, all right, that's a long introduction to it. Why is it significant? Well, we don't quite know yet. I mean, that's part of the question is how significant is this? What does it tell us? That will be the source of lots of questions, you know, from here on out, basically. What happens is initially the editors publish it. They make their initial assessment. They read the text. They transcribe it. And then they try to fill in gaps wherever they think they can. They compare it to other manuscripts. They try to date it. They do all that sort of initial work. And then the rest of us kind of get busy and make what we can of it. In this case, one of the things I could say right off the bat that's important about it is it's early. They dated to the second century. Some have suggested maybe third century. But either way, that's really early. That's as early or earlier than our earliest copy of Mark, of any piece of Mark. So that's significant. It's also seems to be the first time we have something like a canonical gospel mixed with a non-canonical gospel in Greek, that's this early. So that's pretty significant if that sort of pans out. But just more, maybe more in general, it shows that there's a lot we still have left to discover, you know? So we should expect that the next volume of the Oxyrhynchus Papyri will also have new fragments of, probably some of them will be maybe biblical manuscripts. In this same volume, it kind of got pretty overshadowed, but we have a very early fragment of Revelation as well. It's not in the news because we already have a fair, you know, we already have some other early fragments of Revelation. And so this one doesn't really tell us anything new about the text that we didn't already know. But this other fragment does. This seems to be pretty unique. So I could say more about that, I'm sure, but that kind of gives you the gist of it.
Yeah. It's a good example with Oxyrhynchus that one generation's trash is another generation's entire scholarly career.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
I heard somebody say maybe it was Wallace or someone else thinking about the next major manuscript discovery is probably not going to be unearthed by, you know, a shepherd looking for, you know, his in a cave, but it's probably sitting on a library shelf somewhere that, you know, we're going to come across one day and realize what we already had.
Yes, there's a rule for this, a principle named after actually my supervisor, his name is Peter Head. He works a lot with papyri, and so we call it Head's rule. And it's basically that the best place to find new, you know, undocumented manuscripts is in old libraries, and that's certainly fair to say.
Yeah. Well, one of the things any new discovery is exciting in one sense because it adds to our knowledge, and especially if it has texts of things that we're studying. But even in this regard, it takes a while to figure out the significance of it because it has to be interpreted, and then also set within, you know, the rest of the evidence that we have. But usually at this point, it's rarely going to unseat or reorient everything else we know about a particular text or, you know, the development of a text. Would you say that is accurate, or would you frame that in a different way?
Yeah, I think in general, I mean, you know, if you think, okay, if all your theories about early Christianity are overturned by the discovery of a fragment that's the size of an envelope, your theories are probably not very good to begin with. You know, you know what I mean? Like, so that's sort of just like one way to approach it. Like, now, it's not to say like no discovery could ever overturn things. Certainly the Dead Sea Scrolls have had a, you know, massive influence on our understanding of, say, Judaism in that period. But also the Dead Sea Scrolls are a massive discovery. You know, they're like the most famous discovery of manuscripts like that. So Yeah, I think what it tends to be is each one is sort of like a little piece of the puzzle, right? And you try to fit each new piece that you get into the larger puzzle and see, does it require, where might it require me to rearrange some other pieces that I thought were in the right place before, but I realize now, you know what, they don't fit quite as well. So, you know, with something like this, you've got to ask questions like, does this have any effect on the dating of the Gospel of Thomas, for instance? Does it have any influence on how we sort of imagine Gospels being written in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. Lots of Gospels are sort of written from other Gospels. We kind of already know that if you know anything about the synoptic problem, you know that probably Gospel writers tended to use prior Gospels. All right, so in that regard, this fits right in with that that Gospels tend to come from older Gospels, to put it that way. So yeah, you know, it raises interesting questions about the origin, say, of the Gospel of Thomas, or how new Gospels are written, or why. In this case, it's such a small fragment that it's hard to know if this would have been a full codex, like, so it would have been a full sort of literary work, or was it just a single piece of papyrus, for instance, that somebody wrote sayings of Jesus on, and they wrote some from the Gospel of Matthew, and they wrote some from the Gospel of Thomas, you know? So that raises interesting questions about, like, well, what would the purpose of this even have been? And some of those questions never have answers to, because it's so small. Yeah. But we can speculate. We just have to be careful and know that we're speculating, I suppose.
Something that was said last year at the ETS discussion of second century papyri and some of the discussions of dating. Last year, I told my students I was sitting in on a panel on dating, which, you know, much less interesting when you clarify all the dating of papyri manuscripts to the second.
They were like, I want to go to that one.
Yeah. but one of the things that was said are the relative significance of early papyrus manuscript discoveries, for example. Have they changed in any substantive way some of the earlier projections and the earlier models? And one of the responses was that these discoveries haven't necessarily altered that much. But the response was, this is evidence, not that these aren't important, but that the earlier models were developed in, you know, 19th, 20th century were actually good ones. Just the way that they were sorting through this evidence was sound, and that, you know, the discovery of papyrus fragments, even the early ones, hasn't necessarily overturned the way in which, you know, we do textual criticism.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's you may be thinking of Elijah Hickson's paper that he gave last year on the papyri at ETS. And I'd say, yeah, there's a substantial element of truth to what you just said. You know, part of it has to do with, how do we measure significance? And that can be hard to say. You know, sort of like in any discipline, like, are we moving forward or backwards? We're certainly doing new things. We're writing new books all the time.
Right.
People are developing new theories. That's sort of the name of the game when it comes to scholarship. But that the fact that something is new does not actually mean it's, you know, all you have to do is think about what are the number of theories that were new at one point and now are considered passé, or even better, like, when somebody thinks they're presenting some new theory and then somebody else discovers, hey, this is basically the same thing that so-and-so said 100 years ago, but he said it in German and you forgot about it. Like, you know, so measuring progress in our world of scholarship can be dicey, I'll be honest. Yeah. But to the question whether papyri are important, they certainly are. Have they sometimes been overemphasized? Yes, I do think that's true. I think there is a tendency, even in my own discipline, among experts sometimes, to think that papyrus is some kind of magical material, that if something is written on papyrus, it's necessarily more important. That is not true at all. The reason why people tend to think that way, though, to be fair, is because our papyri do tend to be the earliest manuscripts. Or to say it differently, our earliest manuscripts are all papyri, on papyri, right? So we do have some later ones. Like, we have some 7th century papyri that are not especially important, right? But it is true that, say, our earliest substantial copy of Paul's letters is on papyrus. Our earliest substantial copy of the Gospels and Acts is on papyrus, right? Like, you know, I'm thinking of manuscripts like P45, P46, P47, manuscripts like this, P75, for example. Like, these are substantial papyri, and they are very early. So, yeah, the papyri are important, but they're not magical.
Yeah, and you have that problem or caution on both from an evangelical perspective, for example, or from a purely secular perspective, where this new fragment will get a lot of press because it contains text from Thomas. Any text that's early is going to get a lot of press with confessional communities, you know, because we're wanting, you know, want to maximize the early date, or someone else wanting to maximize the fact that there's an apocryphal gospel text somewhere in the mix as well.
Yeah.
So both of those
extremes. It's a good general principle that when you're dealing with historical evidence, you should be careful with things that you really, really want to be true.
Right.
So that's not necessarily true in all of life. Okay. I really, really want it to be true that my wife loves me, and in fact she does. But but when it comes to historical arguments and evidence, it's generally good to say, do I really, really want this to be true? And if you do, then you should at least say, then I maybe should be a little bit more cautious and make sure the evidence is there. So a good example is this was all the hubbub about the first century fragment of Mark that was swirling around a couple of years ago. And some of us got way too excited before we'd even seen it and started thinking that somehow this was going to be great, you know, great additional proof for the resurrection. And I just want to say to people when they think that way, like, doesn't that mean then that without a first century copy of Mark, my confidence in the resurrection should be less? Like, I'm not sure people think that through all the way. Like, maybe what they mean is our evidence for the resurrection right now is good, and it can be better. Fine. But like, still, it's like we just be careful about like what we actually need as evidence as Christians. Like, what does our faith actually require? It does not in any way require a first century copy of Mark to do. Like, it just doesn't. So if you think it does, then you should ask yourself what version of Christianity you're believing in. If I can put it that way.
Yeah. Well, that's a good summative comment as we're kind of ending a discussion of some really technical matters. To conclude, I'd like to ask a general, kind of more reflective question. There's a lot going on in our world that is discouraging, but what is something that you've experienced or reflected upon recently that gives you hope?
That is a very big question. Well, it's not textual criticism, I can tell you that. I mean, I do love it, but that's not what my hope is in. you know, I just came back from the Gospel Coalition and picked up a book while I was there about death and about the importance of thinking about our own death, numbering our days, as the scriptures say, of realizing that worrying about tomorrow does not add a single minute to our life, but that we should take our impending death as a reminder that we need Jesus. And honestly, I found that incredibly encouraging and helpful. It brought a lot of clarity to my own thinking about life. It's very easy to get wrapped up in the immediate. It's also very easy to fall into despair about the way things are changing or things that are being lost, whether it's just personal things. Like in my own case, you know, my kids growing up, it's sad to think that, you know, I don't have a one-year-old anymore, and I'll never have a one-year-old again, probably. But that this life is a prelude to the next life. And the way he describes in the book is he says this life is like the appetizer for the full meal. And a good appetizer is something that whets your appetite for the meal, but it doesn't replace it. And that's the way we should think about this life. It does not replace the life to come, but it does lead into it. And so what we do here matters, but it is not sort of the ultimate thing that matters. What matters most is what happens in the next life. So, yeah, that's something that's given me a lot of hope recently.
Yeah, that's a good word and good example of how counterintuitive sometimes hope is, in the sense that giving us a perspective of life, sometimes remembering that we are dust and to dust we shall return is something that can help reorient us. Well,
that's it. And just, you know, speaking personally, like what I do is fairly technical and textual criticism. At some level, it does not matter very much. Right? But why do I do it anyway? Why do I pour so much energy into it? Because I think it does matter. It matters to the Lord. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians, our work, our labor in the Lord is not in vain in light of the resurrection. So I believe that it does have meaning and significance, but it's not the old. Anyways, sorry. I'm preaching now, but.
No, that's good. It's a good way to end a discussion on textual criticism. So Well, thank you for your time today. I appreciate, I've learned a lot from your works in this area, and thanks for just taking the time to chat.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Chad.
Well, I'm glad that you're here with me here at the end of this episode. If you're still listening, you might be interested in three ways you can support me and the podcast. The first is what you've already done. Listen to this podcast. This year, I'm also writing a weekly newsletter on the canonical approach to biblical studies. So if you're interested in this, you can follow along at chedspellman.substack.com. The second way would be to read, rate, or review any of my books on amazon.com or Goodreads. These are always welcome and are very helpful. My most recent book is An Introduction to the Life and Writings of Irenaeus, an important theologian in the early church. There's a link in the show notes if you're interested. Finally, if you're so inclined, you can buy me a coffee, which is essentially a digital tip jar. Any of these tips go to offset the cost of producing this podcast. You can find a link to this option in the episode description as well. At any rate, Deo Valente, and if the creek don't rise, I'll see you next time. Grace and peace. This episode is partly sponsored by Cedarville University's Graduate School. Cedarville offers over 33 programs in business, leadership, pharmacy, nursing, athletic training, and ministry. Offered both online and on campus, these programs will equip you for ministry and help you succeed in your career, all within your own schedule. To learn more about Cedarville University's graduate degree programs, including the Master of Divinity program that I teach in, go to cedarville.edu/gradpodcast.
I regret to announce this is the end.